Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight, and this is one of my favorite types of shows because we're going to talk to another session guy that has done a lot of different things behind the scenes and up front on stage. My guest is Don Kirkpatrick, and he's been a session player for many years, and we were just talking before the show some of the different things that he was doing. He did a lot of stuff, especially in the 80s. We're going to play some clips from there where the sound was a pretty distinctive type of a sound. And he played with such people as Joe Cocker, Amy Grant, Michael Bolton. And later on, he was touring, and I don't know if you're still touring or
you're still touring
with Rod Stewart.
Yeah.
So I want to welcome him to the show. It's a real pleasure to have him here. And I'm going to play a clip. This is called Rock Me Baby, but it shows some of his slide playing and just another example of great tone. So take a listen to this. A great sound. I love that. That's true live. You can hear the bottles falling on the background.
Yeah, the bottle was the best tone of all.
That was good. Real quick, though, to start it off, what were you using there? I presume you're playing a Strat, right?
I am. I'm playing that one there. That,
the Strat that we have here in the studio. And then what amp were you using or what were you using?
Playing a Princeton I've had since I was like 15, 16. But somewhere along the way, it got modded by Paul Rivera.
Oh, okay.
So it has a tone selector on it, and it has a master volume. But it still sounds really a lot like a Princeton. It just gets a little bit of a wider tone. But I was also using a Mini Z amp with it.
Oh, okay.
And the best part of all was I was going, was going through, like, there's some slap on that from a Boss multi-effects mm-hmm. plastic box that I found in my closet. I don't even know where I got it. And it has some of the softest, roundest, brownest tones in it because it's not even digital. I don't even know if they make them anymore.
Yeah, but, I remember those. Yeah. They're really cool.
I love the delay sound on it because it's really soft and it's kind of mushy and, you know, sort of like an Echoplex thing. And I also was using a gain boost on which was, again, I think it came out of that first Rivera DB, 20 dB boost thing I was telling you
about. Oh, very cool.
It was put into this bad Sesame 80s pedal board. So the whole chain is just a nightmare. But, you know, I was like, I go out and play with Rod, and I'm playing through really kind of high-end stuff, and it can be boutique-y, and it's really cool. I got home, I got this gig, and I thought, this is all I've got. I'm going to use it. I plugged in it and went, fuck. Why have I walked away from this? And it was basically a riff on what I was watching Lukather do when I first came to L.A. before he really even was in Toto. You know, I noticed that he put two deluxes together, and he ran in that Boss chorus. He went into that and then split to mm-hmm. those. And if you have a proper age chorus, you know, they kind of soften and add a little bit of distortion. So this rig is kind of just a leftover thing in the back of my head that I thought, I'll put it together for this gig. And I just felt back in love with that sound.
Did you ever, when you were using delay, did you ever, what I used to do with the Echoplex, because Fenders, you can plug them in series.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I would plug the Echoplex in, plug my guitar in, and then the second input, I would run the Echoplex to another amp. And I found with the slap or with a long delay, you could play faster, and you wouldn't get all mushy and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I used to do that a lot, and I kind of try and do that with this, too, is just to widen the sound, and I don't know, it's just easier to play, you know? You have a real ambiance, you know? It sounds very retro to me.
Well, you're creating it's moving air. There's just nothing like that.
Yeah, you're creating that, yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background, because it's interesting. We were, again, before the show, we were talking and comparing notes. Where you came from and the people, because there was a lot of interesting musicians that came out of where you grew up.
Yeah, I grew up about an hour north of Bakersfield and an hour south of Fresno in a tiny little town which was near Porterville, and anybody who has a Creedence album knows that was a song on their first album, which John Fogerty apparently spent time there. But there were a lot of other people that grew up there. Tommy Johnson from the Doobie Brothers was from Tulare. There was a guy that played, I'm from Lindsay, and there was a guy that used to play drums with all the guys from my high school in Lindsay. Mm-hmm. He was a killer drummer. His name was Steve, and he went to art school later on with one of my ex-wives. And they were both artists. I knew him as an artist, but, you know, I also knew he'd played drums in that band. And I remember I saw him down in L.A. years later, and you know, I thought, well, he's got to be playing drums with somebody who's so good. Saw him at Dante's watching, as I told you, Larry Carl and then Robin mm-hmm. Ford. And he said, yeah, I'm going to start singing. Some band has hired me to be their singer. I've been singing a little while. That was Steve Perry.
He was a drummer.
Yeah, he's a killer drummer. And I think many drummers from Journey will attest to being tortured by him as a drummer because he's really, really good. Yeah, he knows his stuff. You know, he's got great ears. He's a master musician.
So what were your early influences? What were you listening to?
I had a good guitar teacher in Porterville, of all places, who actually, I just remember, came down here and did a lot of sessions. I remember his name was Bob something. Anyway, he quickly turned me on to the blues, to BB, Albert King, stuff like that. I was, the first music I got into as a kid was like show tunes, you know, and musicals. I think I had a sense for just sort of the grandness of it, and the, you know, the orchestration, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. My ears were drawn to that. But quickly, the guitar thing became about blues. Didn't really like the Beatles or anything for
really?
A while. No, not until I heard McCartney sing I'm Down.
Okay.
The screaming. It was basically Little Richard. So that's when I got into that and that kind of guitar. And then, you know, it just kind of fell all over itself. It became Cream.
But you must have been really, well, besides Cream, but you must have been really into the Stones.
I wasn't.
Really?
I wasn't. I thought they were awful at first. And, you know, I mean, if you ever heard that album that they did, Got Live If You Want It, mm-hmm. it's horrific. But now I listen to it now and I go, it's so beautiful. You know, there's such beautiful kids playing with such spirit. I wasn't, but I was into Chuck Berry. And I was into, like, Beach Boys stealing from Chuck Berry and, you know, stuff like that. And so I just had a feel for that older music. And plus, I grew up in a huge Hispanic area. And a group of the people that worked for us lived in a little house down below our property, and they made really good tortillas. At least like at four, I was sneaking down there to beg tortillas off of them, and I was watching them play electric guitars, and I was fascinated by that. And it sounded like what Los Lobos does now when they play bluesy. They're playing very rock and roll. And I remember I was transfixed by that and the fact they were drinking little tiny glasses with something in it. And just shooting them. Yeah, I had no help. You know, there was no mistake I was going to get into this life.
So when did you started your session work here in L.A., right? Or did you start?
I did, primarily, like working with Randy and people like that.
Okay.
And it sort of grew out
so
of it.
So you just kind of fell. How did you get into it?
Well, I knew Randy Sharp, who was Maya's dad, and he came down here and recorded a lot. I think he was doing some stuff with Delaney, mm-hmm. and, you know, he had his own career. And so I recorded a lot at his house. He had a studio in his house in, like...
When was this?
74, maybe.
That's unusual.
Like, yeah, and he had the Chamberlain and all that stuff and the four-track. And he was a great, great, great educator. Thank you again. I found Randy a couple of years ago, me and another guy, and said, I couldn't do anything I do now if you hadn't taught me what you taught me.
That's
in
very
the studio.
Cool.
Yeah, he's a master. And then I kind of, you know, I met other producers, and thanks to Randy, I ended up working in Nashville a lot in the early 80s for a guy named Barry Beckett, who, you know, played piano on a lot of the Aretha things that were cut in New York mm-hmm. and stuff like that. He produced Bob Seger records. He's a huge, huge, huge producer. He passed away recently. He taught me a lot, and I played on a lot of records there.
And then, were you doing a lot of blues stuff, or what kind of stuff were you doing in the sessions?
It was like 70s kind of country pop, you know.
Really?
Rodney Crowell-ish kind of stuff. And that was early 80s. And then in the rest of the 80s, I started playing... I'm not sure how I got into it, you know.
He just kind of fell into it. Because
yeah.
It was interesting, and one of the cuts we're going to play at the end, I'm saving it for the end, is the thing that he did with Animotion called Obsession, which is a story in itself, and we'll talk about that just before the end of the show, because basically it's all sequence and it's technopop, and there's just blazing guitars in there, which is kind of cool. I think that's...
Unusual for that.
Yes, it's totally out of character of that style or genre. But it's interesting because, again, that sound... And I think what I'll do right now is I'm going to play a clip of your session that you did with Amy Grant. And listen to there's a lead that goes on in the background, and I think you have a solo in this. This is called I Will Remember You. And... that sound, we'll break it down. Let's play it for everybody to hear it. But that was like the classic guitar sound for like a distorted guitar all through the 80s. And I remember we were talking about this too, about on TV shows, the rock guitar sound that they was that sound. It was that kind of a thing.
Quintessential tone.
Yeah, let's play this clip and then we'll talk about what you were doing there. This is Amy Grant, I Will Remember You. So that sound, I mean, that type of guitar sound, I've heard it on countless things. So what were you using there? I want to know how you got that sound.
Oh, God, it's going to be so disappointing because, you know, I mean, do you want to talk about what made that sound? I was using a Deluxe.
Yeah, okay, that doesn't surprise me.
It had been modified.
Okay.
It had been modified. So it came close. I basically had a modified sound like a Marshall. Mm-hmm. Front end was modified. And it did sound a lot like a Marshall, a little bit warmer. At times.
The 6V6s.
Yeah, yeah. And I was running an original Tube Screamer into it.
Okay.
And I had a really bad, like, E1010, Yamaha E1010 thing. It was about this big and had giant knobs on it. And it was like a guitar kind of, like, it did a couple delays, and it did pitch bending on it. And I had hooked that up to get that sound. I was working for Michael Marty, and was a producer. Mm-hmm. He was a famous producer. And I hooked all that up, and it sounded pretty close, but Michael was like, nah, it's not quite there yet. And so he went over and like turned on three eventides.
Okay.
Obviously, he'd been there. At that time he was working on Infatuation, mm-hmm. which was a big hit for Rod, who I work with now. And Michael Landau he was the one who, you know, if you go to an effect now, it'll say Landau tone on it. He kind of came up with that, he and some others. And so he just chained up these eventides.
What was he using, the instant flanger, or was he using the delays?
I don't know. He did it just bang like that. It almost was like he had it in chain to make that sound.
Yeah.
I think he probably did. And he just, you know, I just started playing that line. But genius that he is, he goes, I think it'd be, you know, it was like that scene in Amadeus when Mozart goes, wouldn't it be better if you did this? And he just added a few notes to it, and I was like, oh my God, that's like 1,000 times better. I can't believe it. He's a genius. And he was, you know, because oddly, a lot of people say stuff about that little bit on their record. And I, you know,
it's a great guitar line.
I mean, really,
it's very lyrical.
Michael knew guitars inside out. He's a master keyboard player. He plays a solo on Steely Dan's Home at Last, for all you guys that want to check that out, because it's genius. And, you know, even I see Amy from time to time, and she's married to a much better guitar player now, so I'm humble. But yeah,
but can he get that sound?
Dude, that's a tough guy. That guy, I knew him playing at the Palomino, you mm-hmm. know, when he was kind of just doing pickup gigs. And I remember I played in a band, and he came and opened. We're talking about Vince Gill, by the way, and this mm-hmm. was like Pure Prairie League and all that stuff after that. And he was killing it back then. He was always a great guitar player. I remember he was playing a 335. And
now that one that you were doing, that lead, were you using the Strat or using a Gibson?
I was using a hot rodded Strat with a JB in the back.
Oh, okay, because it had that kind of humbucker type of thing.
Yeah, with a Floyd Rose, which is I'm actually using a little bit to curve the notes, to sort of scallop the notes, as people used to say back in the 80s.
Wow, Floyd. Oh, wow, you were using some pretty interesting stuff. So you would use that Deluxe. That was one of your main studio.
Yeah, I use that a lot. And I actually had that amp shipped to Nashville and used that on a lot of stuff, because it got a really sweet tone and sound. You know, guys like engineers like Scott Henderson and stuff would go, wow, how do you get that? You know, it's like
a guy named
Paul Rivera.
Oh, he did that one too.
Yeah,
he did.
Yeah,
it was modded by him. Okay, that's. Yeah, I remember he did a lot. He gave it a lot more. The Fenders or Marshalls, you could get more mid-range. It got a fatter sound.
He was like one of the first to do it. You had to go up to his house, I believe, in Sunland, Tahunga, and drop it off in the garage. And I remember seeing one of Lukather's Deluxes in there, and I was like,
I know that the first album, the first Toto album, which you, when you see him live, he was playing with Marshalls, but I heard he did it with the Deluxes.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize that those little amps, mic'd right, just sound huge. They sound amazing.
I believe that, and it might have been a Marshall, but that stuff that he did on that Boz Scaggs album, where he played all those killer solos like Breakdown and things like mm-hmm. that, I think that might have been the Deluxe.
I heard he used the Deluxe more in studio because the engineers liked it, but he could get that distortion.
And it wasn't so loud as a Marshall, too, so it was easier for them. And it did get a really sweet sound. I use it on a lot of country stuff. I played with like a Cajun accordionist guy named Joel Saunier, mm-hmm. who was just blazing. His keyboard player was Garth Hudson, and his other guitar player was Albert Lee. And somehow I got on the gig, too. And I used that amp on that gig with Albert Lee, and it sounded very, very country, you know.
Oh, I'm sure. It was just... Yeah. Well, those amps are... do you remember what speaker is? Was it just a standard Fender speaker?
I had a Fane in it. You remember Fane speakers? Yeah. That was a Fane that was in that recording there, too, which, as you know, will influence that sound.
Oh, Fanes are cool. Yeah. Frank Marino uses Fanes a lot.
Really?
He's hoarded a bunch of them.
Oh, really?
15s. He uses 15s to get his sound. But those Fanes, there is a definite sound to them.
Very soft, pretty sound comes out of those things. You know, you can't get them to really spank real hard. But they sort of sound like, you know, a lot of country guys used to use AC-30s. A guy like Brad Paisley started off in AC-30s. And it's a killer country sound if you get the right one. Because it'll kind of spank and pop just right. That Deluxe did the same thing.
Yeah. Well, a lot of guys here would use Fenders and JBLs.
Yeah.
You'd see more in L.A.
Yeah.
At least the session guys I saw were using that, which was a great, because it's a very bright speaker, and it worked really well with the Fender amp.
Except for carrying it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those Alnico magnets were very backbreakers. Even with a Deluxe, it would be kind of heavy.
Yeah.
That's true. They didn't have Neomag back then.
Yeah.
But, no, it was an interesting, it was a very interesting sound. But that amp, the Deluxe amp, that was used by the Ventures. That was almost everybody was using those. Larry
the
Carlton.
Eagles used them all over their records. You know, the Hotel California solos and stuff like that supposedly are done on Deluxes. And
yeah. That were very, that's just, yeah. It's a great amp. It's just a legacy amp. Now I'm going to go, I want to play another live clip. And this is the one where I'm going to pick your brains on. Because there's some really cool things that he's doing on this. This is called Bad Reception. And there's two guitar players, right?
Yeah, the other guy's named Steve Moose.
Steve Moose. And what's happening, listen to what they're doing. It's kind of a, it's a little more elaborate than a Stones type of chord lead, if I can call it that, because it's definitely a melodic thing, but it's in chords. But they're playing against each other. And then I cut in, it's an edited thing. This is about 2.5 minutes. And then I edited to where you do the slide lead, which is just awesome. But listen to their sound. Listen to what they're doing, the interplay, and then you can break it down. I want to kind of go into this, because this is a very cool clip of what you're doing here. Here we go. Bad Reception. A guy that didn't really like the Stones, I don't know.
I got into them later on.
That is so cool. And you've got to listen to what's going on. You're doing one thing and the other guy is doing another, and it's that interplay. And I remember hearing that when I saw the Stones play live years ago with Mick Taylor was doing that kind of a thing.
Steve and I are huge, huge Stone fans. I was listening to Blue and Lonesome on the way over here. So, yeah, and I've been lucky enough to play with Ronnie Wood.
Very cool.
So it was a master class in itself, just standing, watching him play. And, you know, but Steve is a master guitarist, too. And the, of all the people I've ever played with in ever my career, he and I just naturally fall into that. That's the only time we've ever played that song like that. We wrote that probably 7 years ago. It's different every time.
Really?
I couldn't tell who was playing what at the top of that. I couldn't tell which was him and which was me for a while.
Well, one was kind of a darker sound. You're the chimier one, right?
I think so, yeah, yeah.
Were you, blah, nah, nah.
Yeah, I can play.
Show me what you're doing.
Okay, I think I was doing. And he was doing. But then later on, I'm doing.
You're using the Strat.
Yeah.
What amp were you using there?
I was using the Princeton again. That same lineup.
Sounds great.
That was the Princeton. That was nothing. That was just this guitar into the Princeton and that
no,
little.
No effects or
no,
anything.
No effects on there. No boost or anything.
What was he using?
I don't even know the name of the guitar. He's got a Gibson that's like the weirdest Gibson I've ever seen. It looks like it was at one time a Les Paul. It hasn't been modded. It was something they made probably in the late 70s, early 80s, and it's got like flat pickups on it, two of them. And
P90s?
No, it's not P90s. It's like something.
Not humbuckers.
No, I've never seen them before. And
they look like blade ones?
Yeah, almost, yeah.
It's probably the Les Paul recording, the one with the little.
No, it wasn't that with those like blade things. This is like a flat thing. It almost looks like a weird like Tysco Del Rey Dan Electro type.
Oh,
vibe.
Wow.
Yeah, really opaque sounding guitar. We, you know, I early on was way into Chuck, as was he. So we put these two guitars together on certain things, and it sounds just like Chuck Berry records.
Well, that interplay, and then when you do that kind of, you're mouthing to me, humble pie, because you're doing this kind of thing. Yeah. It's kind of a Steve Marriott type of thing.
Totally, totally.
And it's great. Yeah. But the blend of the two guitars and what you're doing riff-wise, because you're both riffing, but it works. It's the counterpoint, really.
We just, you know, we both kind of feel the same music, and that's just how it happens. You know, he and I play, just bounce back and forth when we play all the time. You know, play solo here, play solo there.
Now, is that the band, the Painkillers?
Yeah, the Painkillers.
That is the Painkillers. Yeah. Okay. Because that is so cool. You got to do that again.
That band does it a lot. You mean I got to play it right now again?
No. I mean, you got to play that. You guys both have, with both of you guys there, that is the coolest.
I'll tell you, try and make it a quick story. I have a minute to tell a story about that.
Oh, you
part,
got time.
That
we
thing
have time.
That I play
we
like
time.
This. Well, I always knew how to play that, you know, and if you listen to Stones records, it's all over it. But when I auditioned for Rod, that was a big part of the audition was play, you know, you had to play what he calls ruckas. He calls them rucka, 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 like that. And it's genius. Nobody knows that playing that kind of guitar better than him. He knows it intuitively. And over the years, he really just, like, was on us, myself and Paul Warren, both joined the band, and taught us how to really, really play it. You know, it's I can't thank him enough. It's a very zen exercise in playing guitar because you've got to learn how to do it, and then you got to forget that you're doing it.
So he's very specific what he wants for you for guitar-wise.
You know, he lets you do a lot of stuff. I've been there so long, it's hard for me to remember. He was specific at first, but you couldn't even have gotten in the door if you didn't kind of have it down. You know, I'd played most of his set in a club before I ever joined the band, you know, so I'd had practice.
So you knew all, you knew everything.
I didn't have to learn some guys. I'd played it a billion years, you know, things like that.
No, I was just waiting for you to do some Jeff Beck stuff with him because he used to do all the stuff with Beck.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
Like Ain't Superstitious with the wah-wah with the slap echo.
Yeah, we very rarely have done that song, but we do Infatuation every so often, and I do get to play the solo on that, so. And it's fun, you know.
I mean, some of that stuff he did was just magic. I mean, it was very, 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 very cool.
It is. It's amazing to get to play that.
Now, you mentioned too that you did a lot of stuff in Nashville.
Yeah,
and we were talking about the fact that you know where did you get people were like you got these country licks down, but you weren't really a country player though. You had, I think, your influence was Bakersfield because you were close enough to Bakersfield.
Absolutely. Growing up in, you know, high school bands and stuff and just guys that would come around the little bars that I'd play in and stuff when I was young, a lot of them were in Merle's band or Buck's band. I remember particularly a keyboard player in particular was just killer. And, you know, we would watch these guys and just sort of soak it up, and I'd get to play with them every so often. but also, you know, it was a big Hispanic area up there. And so I would, the you know, the workers who worked for us would live in a house below us, and I'd sneak down there, hear them play music. It sounded very much like Los Lobos. They had two tiny little amps and electric guitars, nothing else, and they'd eat tortillas and...
But very blues-based.
Very blues, interesting. Very bluesy, very rock and roll-y sounding. But, you know, it still had that sort of norteño sound. And that was in my blood. But, you know, just turning on the radio, driving in the truck with my dad out to the groves, I had to be hearing it every day because I never really had to, like, try and play this country stuff. It just kind of spilled out.
Well, how did you like... Now, when you were playing with Rod Stewart, you were in England? A lot, or were you out here?
No, he's lived out here for years. So,
oh, okay.
You know, we auditioned out here and joined the band out here. And we
now,
play all over the world.
But, okay, you were doing sessions in L.A. and around the 80s, mm-hmm. and then you were doing sessions in Nashville.
Yeah.
What was the difference? What was it like to do that? Because that, I know it's hard to tell now because a lot of rockers now moved over to Nashville.
Yeah, everybody I was doing sessions with in the 80s are in Nashville doing sessions now, or were a while ago. They've kind of been phased out, but... I remember going to Nashville and, like, in between doing songs, we'd play Freeway Jam. Michael Rhodes on bass, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and I'd be going, la-da-da-da, you know, with all the whammy and shit. They're like, play more of that. I'm going, I came here to play country. And, you know, in the 80s sometimes we'd play country stuff in between. It just, you know, it kind of just transmogrified.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of the same sounds now have moved over to country.
Well, it's, I think, country... popular country,
yeah.
And it's very, there's not much difference between rock and roll.
Right.
It's pretty similar.
Right.
But I mean, but in terms of the vibe of the place, I mean...
Oh, the vibe of Nashville back in the 80s was really cool. It was really fast. We'd bang out three songs, go to, you know, lunch, bang out three more songs, get up next day, do it again. And these were like complete tracks. Bang them out, and then maybe I'd stay after a little bit later at night and do overdubs for guitar. And Billy Payne was playing piano, and he'd do overdubs. And then that went on for, like, I think 14 days or something, you know, sometimes. And
well, that was a lot of, like, the session times in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And it was pretty quick. And
in the 80s, I remember with, like, Michael Mardian, you know, we would, like, get up a sound, and then he'd always was into eating great Italian food. We'd go eat for hours and then come back and play a little bit. And then, you know, Amy would come in at night, and I'd watch her do a vocal or two, and then I'd put on a little thing and then go away. It was much more relaxed, you know, whereas the Nashville thing back then was very factory-like, but not in a bad way. It was just very, very efficient.
Yeah.
And well, I just remember I ate constantly in Nashville. And all those guys wanted to do was eat when they weren't playing, so. But, you know, they were...
But all that Italian food, I'm surprised you stayed awake. You probably wanted to take a nap.
Oh, I did. It was rough, but... You know, the players in Nashville were just master musicians. I felt completely out of my league. I was terrified when I first got there, you know. But after a while, you know, they accepted.
I know that in the old days they used to have a different notation than here.
Yeah.
Did you use the number notation? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. That growing up around where I was from, the only kind of reading I really, really learned was that for a while.
Really?
Yeah, until I came down here. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
interesting.
There's some old boys up there that knew that one. And
yeah, because I never heard of it on the West Coast. I knew about it from Nashville.
Yeah, so I kind of had that from up there, but I got down here. I was like, I got to start.
It was also the other thing that was amazing was like the string charts that they would do in Nashville. They do head charts.
Yeah.
All the string players. Like, how do they
do that?
I mean, I've heard vocalists do head charts where they'll just sit there and do a full three-part harmony, set it up, okay, blah, 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 record. But I've never seen string players do that.
Listen to the strings like on old Willie Nelson records and stuff from early 60s. Just like...
Yeah, there were no charts.
Yeah,
they just
how'd
did
they do that.
Yeah, the concert master guy. Okay, let's do this. Okay, fine. And they had, I think they had those chord number, the way they had it, the Nashville chord charts.
Yeah,
all they needed. And they would just sit there and it just blows me away.
I mean, it's still, you know, master musicians just come out of that town, too. Just unbelievable nowadays. So,
but I remember in the 80s, too. Well, in for album-oriented stuff, in television and like multimedia stuff, which I did a lot of sessions there, that was always under the gun and really fast.
Yeah.
But they would let you work on a sound and spend a few hours.
Yeah,
I remember
exactly.
They would spend 5 or 6 hours getting the drums right and stuff like that. And I think, you know, and especially I really like Omardian's work with Christopher Cross, that first album, just the sound of it was so open. I mean, it just you know, all the percussion and stuff, it just was crystal clear, and it deserved the Grammy.
Yeah, it did. And he just has superb ears, you know.
Now, some of the other people that you played with. You played with, I was looking up on your bio, that you played with Joe Cocker and Michael Bolton. Were those through Amardian or were the other producers?
No, Michael Bolton was, I did a record date with him through another producer I knew from in the 90s. And I believe Joe was just some live stuff here and there.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
And what was it? I also worked a lot with Eric Burdon, but that wasn't recording. So
live? Working live?
Yeah, I was in his live band for a while. I just threw that in because I loved playing with him.
Well, that must have been interesting because wasn't he a big blues aficionado too?
Killer, like a big, great blues shouter. You know, and the story was that Mick hated him, and after I played with him, I realized why. He's like
really
a serious, serious singer. Also, Brian Auger was playing keyboards in that band. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, it was just a serious hang on for your life kind of situation. Because I remember the first gig I did, Brian played a long solo. It was just stunning, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to do this, like, for this whole months that they've booked me. I can't play solo after solo after that guy. It's like amazing. It was so
humbling.
That's
true. How do you follow somebody?
Yeah, so humbling. You know? Two Marshalls, please.
Two Now, let's talk a little bit about how your sound, and especially the equipment that you use. You have various pedal boards, and you were telling me you have over the years from rack systems.
Yeah.
How has your sound evolved? Is it gotten simpler? You do use some pedals, but you don't use that many as before. Just kind of go through a little bit your evolution, because it's interesting to see where your ear was and how it evolved.
I think you can gather from what I said, I've started off one place a long time ago, like with amps and front loading them and stuff, and I've ended up back there now. Like the sounds you're playing is basically that's what I'm doing, was what I learned how to do as a kid. You know, I see a lot of people come up now and they like get just a good clean sounding amp and then they just put all pedals into it to get all the sounds. I was more like we were talking about Humble Pie. And I still, like I was telling you, I still check out amps by playing I Don't Need No Doctor.
Right,
that's
right,
an
right,
ultimate
right,
sound. Yes. Les Paul into Marshall, that kind of breakup, which is an extreme, but it's almost orchestral. You know, a Les Paul into Marshall is an orchestra. Jimmy Page proved that. But over the years, I got into all the stuff. I bought one of the first Tube Screamers. I had a TC Electronics little box. And I got all the Yamaha delays and an Eventide and all that stuff. I went through Boogies, Boogie Mark III's. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I played Dumble for a while. I did modified Bassman Heads. I had a Fender Pro amp I played in high school, which I still wish I had. That was a great odd amp. And then, you know, as I started in the 90s forward, it was Marshall, you know. And I still love, you know, I've got a 70s Marshall I just love.
Mm-hmm.
I use that a lot with Rod. Got into the boutique amps, you know, stuff like that, divided by 13s and things like that.
But basically, those are modded to make it sound like a great Marshall or a great Fender.
Exactly.
So you were more a Marshall guy. Even though your Fenders were modded, but didn't like that? Like, were you after the ever like that Larry Carlton sound? Or?
Absolutely. I can still play Kid Charlemagne note for note. That's part of the reason I got my my Princeton modded, because somebody told me that really what he played that on was a modded Princeton that Paul Revere had done. And I played my 335 in that. It sounds exactly like that record. I saw on some YouTube, he said it's an old, you know, tweed Princeton, but I don't think so. I think it's the modded one. And so, yeah, I was way into him. I still love his playing. I was like all of us here. The guy just, you know, just injected harmony into great blues and rock playing.
Uh-huh.
You know, on such a complex level. I love it to this day.
Yeah. Well, no, that the sound of those amps, one of the mods that I heard that I always wanted to do, but I don't think he's alive anymore, was Red Rhodes did a mod.
Yeah, I heard about those.
It's like a 60-watt RMS Princeton. It's like screamer. Right. He'd play steel in it.
Yeah.
And it's just really clean.
There were a lot of guys around town when I first moved here I thought were playing through those, because I remember seeing Princetons that were so loud. I was like, what? You know, and I couldn't even get my basement to be that loud.
Yeah, no, they were it was 60 watts, and I think there was a 12 put in it.
Yeah,
and it was a Red Rhodes mod, mostly for pedal steel, but it had a great sound.
It's funny how this happens, because you know, you and I, we grew up wanting to have a Marshall, and in this part of the world, when they were really popular, like with Clapton and Cream, Hendrix and stuff, they weren't around. And particularly up where I'm from, in the middle of nowhere, you know, there was nothing like that around. I was always chasing that sound, so I ended up using Fenders, and then maybe one kind of thing to kind of push it a bit or get a really high gain.
Which is funny, because Marshall basically emulated the bassman.
Exactly. But so it just goes round and round.
The other thing is that people don't realize is back then, the Marshalls were 220 volts.
Right.
So they didn't have multi-voltage back then. So if you bought a gray market one, you could buy one cheap, but you couldn't play.
Yeah. No.
You'd have to get a voltage converter or something, which are rare too.
Yeah. And that all kind of changes the sound a bit too.
So. And it did. And that people say there's a difference between, even with the Fenders, because the Beatles had 220 ones.
Yeah.
And the sound from 220 to 110 affected, especially the Marshalls. I heard that was a big difference.
I've played, you know, I play in England a lot, and it's absolutely true. You know, they just, it sounds like that stuff you heard on records.
Right,
when you play it here.
And what we were talking about, where he was saying, I don't need no doctor, is the Rock in the Fillmore by Humble Pie, a classic tone. If you want to hear tone of that Marshall just full out, that's the album that shows you that. That's the Bible in terms of that type of brand.
And two guitars through two Marshalls. And to make it work sonically and tonally, you know, they don't get in the way. It is truly orchestral in a way.
Yeah, it's truly a great sound. But it's interesting because of all of that, did you find when you were doing sessions, did they would process you after the effect so you would just get a
not so much. Michael Martin, you know, was like, when it was like, whoa, dude, you're like really going at this. You know, I wasn't used to that. It's like you had to bring it. I remember I did some stuff, a few things for like Mike Post, you know, who did a lot of TV stuff. Mm-hmm. And you had to have all that stuff on right now to make it sound like that kind of sound that's all over.
So they expected you to just give them
walk in and have it. And, you know, I wasn't ever really that kind of session player, but a friend of mine, John Goo, did tons of that stuff. And it was like you had to have all that stuff laid out in front of you, ready to go.
Yeah,
and click it on right there as you're reading down the chart.
And even for the sessions, like an Amy Grant or something, they wanted you to have everything set up.
Yeah, we did, but it was more creative and slow. I mean, you know, Michael was building the record, and so it way more slow and creative than, say, like in Nashville. Barry knew exactly what he wanted. It had to be like this, and it was a little more formula, but Michael was like still looking for sounds.
Because, the reason I'm asking that is, like, for example, flanging or... any type of phasing, if you do it from the pedal, it you lose a lot of highs.
Yeah.
Whereas if you get a great distorted sound, like with a Marshall or your Deluxe or something like that, to flange it or phase it in the board, it gets more shimmery and it gets a
which is what you're hearing on that Amy track, I think. I think he eventually had me turn everything off
and you're
Yamaha
playing straight.
Thing. Yeah,
and I was and you're playing straight. Because it really makes a difference. It really does... you know, at least for me, the effects, like an Eventide effect, always was pretty clean, full frequency.
Yeah.
And flanging, a lot of the real cool stuff is up in the higher end.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
I remember it felt like God when I was playing that track in the studio. It was big speakers above me. And I felt like I barely had to touch the guitar. It was just like, it went from like Melrose down to Long Beach. It's that wide.
So you were in the control room.
Yeah.
They would put
yeah.
the, oh, uh-huh. That's interesting.
Yeah. I did all the guitar work in the control room.
And you were, well, you, most of the stuff you're doing, you're not doing a lot of feedback, but that was always a problem, trying to go through the speakers.
Yeah,
because you can control
that.
It in front of the amp.
And Michael, I just remember this, he called that sound Spilkus, which is, you know, I think a Yiddish word for like schmutz or stuff. You know, he goes, it needs more Spilk.
More Spilk.
And that's, you know, that's also a lot of what the 80s were like. It was kind of like just guys having fun like that. And in Nashville, it was more like bang, 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 bang. But in a good way.
Yeah. Well, but that creative time, all those people that were playing all those albums. Everybody was singing on everybody's stuff. You know,
there was all a club. Group. It was the coolest club on the planet. I studied that club. You know,
right.
We talked about that. To this day, I still kind of come from that. Those players.
Now, so, you always used a Strat, or did you ever? I mean, for the most part, you even with Rod or whatever, you're using a Strat all the time, or do you use any Gibsons?
I use tons of stuff. I've got Juniors. I've got couple Les Pauls. I like a lot of Tellys. I just have a Strat at home. Most of my stuff moves around out on the road. I started off playing 335s only for mm-hmm. years.
That was a staple session guitar.
Yeah, just absolutely. I still love that guitar, but I'm not as drawn to it.
But
these days.
You play a lot of slide on the mm-hmm. on the Strat, which is more of a curved fingerboard than a Gibson.
Yeah.
But did you ever play slide on the Gibson or more?
Yeah. I started off playing slide on the Gibson. I started off like. Playing like old blues licks, and then I heard Duane Allman, and it was like, forget about it. I got to learn how to do this. And then I learned where some of that was coming from, and went backwards with it.
Well, okay, but I mean, you prefer now the Strat over the?
I do. Yeah, I like that because I'm really in now. You know, you start
you
off,
and Bonnie.
Yeah,
Bonnie.
Yeah, and plus all the guys like that came out of Chess and Chicago and stuff were playing more Fendery sounding guitars. Sometimes they were playing. Just junk sometimes too, but it sounds so cool. My big passion now is trying to chase that sound of really old sort of 40s and 50s blues guitars like Hubert Sumlin, things like that. Muddy Howlin' Wolf.
Well, a lot of guys are collecting these very old hi-fi amps that were very primitive for the day, but they basically just clip them and they do sound amazing. I mean, it's a whole other world, but they're like nowhere. I mean, no name amps are very.
And sometimes I want to get that sound like that BB uses on "You Upsets Me" and stuff like that. And it's just the clunkiest, just doggy sounding guitar. It sounds beautiful to me. And sometimes I hear that Princeton sound, I go, God, that's just, it's too good. It's not right, you know? So, you know, it's funny how you chase a sound, you try and get it super glitzy, and then I feel like I'm going completely back to the first stuff I heard, you know, like those.
Well, the Princeton, it just, it's a very good.
Yeah.
It has what I call bloom, the distortion that you get.
Absolutely.
It's
bloom is a word I haven't heard in years, but that it's all about.
It's just a little bit when you dig into the guitar, it just gets a little bit of distortion, and it just fattens it up a little bit, a little compression from the tube, and it's a great. But when you play slide, those slide leads that you played, that has that. It's just
that
really,
was a tube screamer into the. It was the original one of the first ones that I ever found in L.A. John, I think we got it at Valley Arts and. That was
for
the slide on
the Bad Reception.
Yeah, that was.
I just
kicked the tube screamer on this Strat, and that's all it was.
Do you have it gained up a lot, or are you just basically using it as an overdrive?
I'm using it more as an overdrive, just to push. Those old ones, and I swear it's changing as it gets older. I know this is insane to say.
No, you're not.
I'm not. Oh, when we get off the air,
the circuits deteriorate.
That. Well, it's deteriorating in the best friggin' way.
That thing
sounds better this month than it did last month.
Yeah,
those
transistors
really?
Do wear.
I was
eventually it'll fail.
Oh, I was afraid of that. Oh well.
But it's just like I remember my bandmaster. It sounded really great just before I blew the speakers.
And I remember David Lindley saying that about stuff he did, too. That amp sounded great right before it died permanently.
But, if it just depends on how much you use it. But I think that, they do. The circuits do change a little bit.
Yeah, and so it's bigger, warmer sounding. And I just, I listened to that solo and I thought, God, we did some gigs with Rod where Stevie opened up for Stevie Nicks, and mm-hmm. Waddy Wachtel was playing with her. I loved his slide playing when I was a kid. The stuff he did on the Ronstadt albums, I still think it's genius slide playing. Obviously, he's good because Keith calls him to play slide on his records.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm listening to that solo, and I'm just basically playing poor, poor, pitiful me slide solo that Waddy did. And it works on anything. It's just so soulful what he plays. And, he's a great, great guitar player. And really sweet guy.
If you haven't done it yet, eventually you will have to recap your Fenders if you haven't done it.
I've been through that.
And that
times.
Was sad because it's like they're not exactly the same.
I know.
It sounds pretty good, but I mean, it's again, they don't make them like they They did back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, I keep these things. I don't ever play the Tube Screamer unless it's on that gig, you know. And I don't really play the Princeton that much. And
but you should be able to. Some of the new ones that they, the hand-wired ones, should
yeah,
sound pretty
yeah.
close.
No, there's great sounding amps out there besides.
And I mean in terms of the pedal. Oh. And then if you use the Germanian transistors,
yeah,
it would be mellower.
Right.
There is a difference. It makes. And they're out there. I know they're rare, but there's plenty of them where it's not exorbitant, yeah. you know, to do that. Well, we're almost out of time, and before we leave, I want the backstory on Animotion Obsession and this whole thing, because it's a great guitar sound. But first, I wanted to mention, Lord, he's
gig
playing,
time?
So people can tell where he's...
Gig time. So that last track that you did with Steve Moose and Donnie, that band is called The Painkillers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's another Painkillers, but it's the local LA
Painkillers. We're
running
out of time. Yeah.
No, you're
no, we're good. We're good.
I'm kidding.
So there's another gig coming up on February 11th, mm-hmm. and it's at the Unurban Cafe in Santa Monica on Pico Boulevard. And there's a Facebook page, Painkillers Music, I think it is. So you can like the page and look for the invite.
Yeah, I'll put a link in when I post the pictures up and so that they can go to the site and see that. Yeah, before I want to talk a little bit about this cut, but before that, I just want to go ahead and thank you. And you have to come back because
I want to interview you next time.
Oh, we'll
yeah,
do that.
You'll
do that.
You didn't, nobody knows what he was talking about before we went on air, but he's got great stuff. Great stuff. I had so much fun. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, no, no. Well, you definitely have to come back. And you're always welcome to come and hang with us.
Oh, love
whoever
to.
I have yeah. over here. It's always good to have another guitar player here to
yeah.
sit in with
and
us.
And plus, you get it. You know, you get it's not all about just pedals and items and stuff. It's also how you play, the emotion you play with, what you put into your music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. yeah. No. And you yeah. definitely do. Yeah. I mean, thank very you. Expressive. And I have to, it's just, your tone is killer.
Oh, thank
I'm
you.
Jealous. I'm jealous. I want that Princeton. Never sell that in the deluxe. Those two. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about this cut that you did for Animotion called Obsession. Let's talk about that session because it's interesting. It's a very dense techno pop thing with a lot of sequencers and synths in it, and you made room for guitar in there, and it's amazing. It really works well.
Well, you make it sound like it was so well thought out and everything. It was completely the opposite. I played to a very bare track. We got sent a track from the writers. It was on Fairlight. It was just drums and pads, and they kind of marked out the vocalist marked out the vocals. Like, you're my obsession. It's on. They left that on the track, and the producer said, go put some guitar on this. And so I put little bits and pieces on it, and it was like 10 minutes of track.
Yeah.
And as it towards the end, I started playing some like wanking basically. And I look at the glass door, and the producer's like going, move it on, move it, keep playing. And I was like, I don't know what to play over this. I'll play what I've been practicing this week. So I started running through all my licks and kind of Eddie Van Halen, White Lion things I'd been learning, and was having fun with it. And then I stopped, and you can hear me stop playing, and they're screaming at me, this pounding on the door, keep playing. So I just kept playing, and I, you know, finally the thing ran out. I played. And I walked in, and I said, okay, well, let's go back and do it. I'll do it for real. They go, no, we're not touching that. And this is the first time I'd ever had that happen in the studio. They said, and I was like, no, ha, ha, ha. No, you really, we're not going to touch it. We're going to leave it. And I was like, oh, God, I hate this band. It's awful. Why are they torturing me? And, you know, the song became a really big hit, and I was just, and, the, you know, I heard
it. Oh, yeah. No, I remember it when I played it. I'm like, I remember this. This
yeah,
is really
I got
cool.
to hear it, and, you know, it was the first thing I ever really played some stuff on that I got to hear on the radio, so it was a real joy, and to this day I'm proud of it now. But
it's great. No, it's a great cut, and just so people understand, back then when they did these dance cuts, they were much longer because they
yeah.
would go into the discotheques and they would run, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes sometimes, some of these dance mixes
yeah,
they did. That's what that was.
They would do a 12-inch, they called
EP.
Them or something
yeah.
like that. Yeah,
extended play.
And it would run, and they would want you to just keep playing. And again, what they were probably doing, they just wanted to cover their bases.
Yeah.
So they had him play like just this extra long thing. Then they could chop it up and cut it up with the way they wanted later.
Which
especially
they,
with the Fairlight, they could have.
Yeah, yeah, but they didn't.
They didn't. But
the
it was
thing
good.
Is, it is all straight through, just as it was played, and kind of with the singers too. Everything it was so bizarre, because you know, this was like 85 that we cut it. It wasn't, you know, it came out later on, and so it was kind of crude how we did it, but. you know, it has a sound.
Well, it's not really an accident, but it's like one of those things. Yes. Like, yeah, this is cool. We'll just keep going with it.
Yeah.
It's one of those, which those are some of the best things.
And that's the only time I ever used a dumble. I borrowed a dumble.
You had a dumble, and you were using a Strat?
I was using a hot rodded JB pickup in a Strat with a Floyd Rose.
Oh, okay. The same one you were using on the Amy Grant.
Different one.
Oh. Oh, wow.
That's, went through a lot of guitars in the 80s. But, yeah, that was the only time I ever used a dumble, and you know, it was fun.
That is so cool. Okay, well, listen, thank you so much for being on the show, and you definitely have to come back. Here's this clip, and you'll hear this guitar lead. And well, there's some guitar stuff, and then you'll hear this lead. It's very, very cool. Everybody have a great night, and we'll see you next week.